Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa.
Hello, you're welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing food and nutrition security in Southern Africa. Joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Laura Castro, the Regional Director for Southern Africa at the World Food Programme, and from the capital of Botswana, Harare, is Duncan David Samikwa, Senior Program Officer for Food Security and Agriculture with the Southern African Development Community, or SADC. I have to say that Rola and Duncan, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. A pleasure for us as well.
You're most welcome. And of course, the feeling is mutual. Now, let me come to you immediately, Laura Castro, who probably doesn't have any relationship with the Castro brothers. You know, as my friend, colleague Paul Neo earlier said, I think that here at Straight Talk Africa, we owe you congratulations. And we are talking about the World Food Programme as an agency having won the most coveted prize. We are talking about the Nobel Peace Prize for 2020. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. And we are really humbled and honored. And I must say, I mean, it's for all of us. It's not only for World Food Programme. It's for all those NGOs, all those UN agencies, all those partners, all those colleagues, governments that work with us. And especially, I must say, it is very special for all our colleagues in the field that are almost 20,000 in the deep field as well, in very remote locations in the world. So they are the happiest ones on this prize. Thank you very much for that.
No, you're most welcome. How much of it did you, by the way, contribute? I am talking about the Southern African, you know, work that you are doing. How much of that was it part of that important contribution?
We hope we were a big important part of this contribution because we are one of the six regions that WFP has in the world. So, and in this region, we have very many problems, especially in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mozambique, where the link between hunger and conflict is very evident. And as you know, it's very clear that hunger and conflict are a vicious cycle, let's say. Sometimes the hunger is the one originating the conflict. It starts by disputes, dispute of land, dispute on food, etc. And there is violence and then it becomes conflict. In other times, you have, in fact, the conflict, what the consequences of the conflict will be people displaced, people moving out, leaving their harvests, their houses, having to go somewhere else, and being really hungry and food insecure. So if you want, the interlinkages are very clear. And in our region, unfortunately, Eastern Congo, as you very well know, has been in that situation for many years, since the 90s. And recently, unfortunately, we're seeing in northern Mozambique, in Cabo Delgado, this happening. And World Food Programme, obviously, we work in these two areas with our professionals in the ground, with the government authorities, the NGOs, the civil society, the communities, to try to alleviate that hunger and ensure that people don't suffer and at least that they have minimum livelihoods. So I will say that in Southern Africa, we have also very much contributed, because every single WFP staff member, every single WFP program where we are and partners, we have all contributed to it. It's about all the years we have been working on that. Since 1961, WFP is on the ground doing this. So if you want, we all assume that we are all part of the Nobel Prize winning.
Very interesting. Let me check out how much of the public relations you have actually done. Duncan, to what extent would you say that when the World Food Program won the big one, that people, for example, in Havarone, people in Botswana, knew exactly what was going on? And if they did, what was the reaction?
Thank you, Shaka. It was quite a pleasure for WFP to win this prestigious prize. When we had it, of course, at an individual level, I was very happy, and people around me, having worked a bit for WFP. But at the SADC level, I think the first thing that our office did is the ES sent a letter of congratulations to WFP. And it happened a couple of weeks after we had just had a meeting following up on a memorandum of understanding we had just signed with WFP. We had been discussing action plan on working together as the two organizations. So we feel part of the WFP, we are proud of the achievement.
Very interesting. Rona, what is the mission of the World Food Program?
Yeah, our mission, in fact, Shaka, is really very wide, but we can say we are the United Nations agency mandated to stop hunger or to achieve zero hunger, obviously, together with other colleagues, UN agencies like FAO and IFAD, who are also in Rome, like us, in fact. We're all based in Rome. But basically, you will see World Food Program shining at its best when there are basically conflicts, floods, cyclones like the ones we saw in Mozambique and Zimbabwe and Malawi last year, the Idai and the Kenneth. When there is distress in the communities, droughts, we will be trying to really alleviate that hunger through participating and working with the communities and government and civil society to ensure that the people can eat every day and they don't go into very many problems like nutritional, the children have nutritional problems, the community has to take a special negative coping mechanism to survive. So that's one part. The second part we do, and we do a lot more of that, is to really work, for example, with smallholder farmers to ensure that they produce more and they access the markets so that there is sustainable food security in the communities. And in Africa especially, we're doing so much more of building resilience. We all know the climate change is here and it's here to stay. And it's affecting everybody. Southern Africa depends mostly on maize harvest. And I'm sure Duncan will give you more details later on how the maize harvest is affected by it rains less or it rains later, and how many people then are affected and cannot sustain themselves on a daily basis. So basically, World Food Program will be there also, working with those communities and governments and authorities locally and nationally to ensure that there are assets built like ponds, like gardens, like reforestation, like irrigation systems, which will ensure these communities will have a longer-term food security. So basically, we do everything around food security, from emergencies to development, and it's basically to reduce hunger, and to reach, to have this world out of hungry people. At this moment, as you know, 700 million are going to bed without eating adequate meals, of without having an adequate food every day. So really very worrisome, and it's just getting worse, Shaka. That's the main problem. Yeah.
Very interesting. Duncan, SADC, the Southern African Development Community, is made up of 16 countries. And I'm sure that you have had the opportunity to pretty much, get a sense of what people feel in that important regional economic bloc. To what extent do you find the average SADC citizen aware or conscious of the work, the great work, in fact, of the World Food Program?
Thank you very much for that question, Shaka. So out of the 16 member states, the feeling would differ from one to another, because like Aurora is going to admit, the presence of WFP is prominent in others where they've got large relief programs, and a bit less in the middle to higher income countries. So you talk about your South Africa, although they're based in Johannesburg, they don't have a big humanitarian program in Johannesburg, Botswana. But in the majority of the member states, WFP is a key partner, actually the lead agency in terms of humanitarian assistance. And because of that, they are so ubiquitous, everyone knows WFP and what they do. I would say that, Shaka.
Yeah. Where, Laura, where do you have much presence in SADC countries? Are we talking about countries like, for example, Zimbabwe?
Yeah, definitely. We have 12 country offices, in fact, 12 countries where we have really a large presence, as Duncan very well said, in the SADC. And in some, we have very small presence because what we do, we have gone out of very big operations. Let me mention, for example, in Angola. Angola in the 90s, when there was a conflict, we had a very large operation. The largest operation in Africa for World Food Program was in Angola at that time. And then we scaled down and then reduced the office to a very small outlet. And now what we do is basically technical assistance with the government of Angola and other partners. SADC is very much involved on looking at vulnerability assessment. You mentioned, Shaka, Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, of course, is one of our large operations due to a number of areas like financial crisis, due to the drought, the recurring droughts related to climate change. So in Zimbabwe last year, we reached around 4 million people that were in need of food security. And of course, government and NGOs reach more numbers as well. But DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, so we have large operations, as well as Mozambique as well. We have quite large operations related to drought, cyclones, and conflict. In Mozambique, if you look at the south, you have a drought. If you look at the central, you have the cyclone affected area of Manica and Sofala. And if you look at the north, you have the conflict in Cabo Delgado and surrounding provinces. So that's more or less what the big operations. But then we have very many operations, like we work a little bit with the government of Botswana on some food, nutritious foods, and we give technical assistance. So we have a wide range, and as Duncan very well said, in some countries we are very prominent and we have large operations, in others not so, but we do a lot of technical assistance and resilience, if you want, support. Yeah.
What about the funding? Where do you get the bottom line from? Where do you get the money to run your operations?
Yeah, the World Food Program globally, for example, last year raised $8 billion. And we reach over 100 million people around the world, around in 80 countries approximately. That's in general. In this region, we did around 17 million people. And basically, where does the money come from? I mean, there is different sources. You have first the governments. The governments of donor countries, we call them, but also the governments in the countries where we work, they also contribute. Like yesterday, for example, I was looking at the Republic of Congo, how they contributed 72 metric tons of salt to support the school feeding program in the Republic of Congo. School meals, there are over 200,000 children in very isolated areas in Congo where the government of Congo will put the salt and the donors will put the maize meal or the cassava and the beans and the oil. So there is a contribution by several actors. Another one will be the private sector. We get a lot of from private sector, and we must not underestimate the individual giving. The individual giving is becoming very important. The individuals who feel like they can contribute to a better world, to a world without hunger, they do put a little bit, $1 or $2, and that $1 or $2 may have a meal, 2 days meal for a child in a school, or a nutritious meal in a center, in a health center for an undernourished child or a pregnant woman. So, you know, every contribution is valid, small or large. We have a wide range of donors, yeah, in fact, Shaka, yeah.
Historically, of course, since 1961, the World Food Program has really been known for working largely in conflict countries, conflict
Correct.
Areas. To what extent has, for example, the recent floods connected to climate change and to the coronavirus pandemic affected that way of the World Food Program conducting its business?
Yeah, look, as you very well said, we work in conflict areas, and the countries in conflict, they make the largest number of people we support in the world, if you want. And this is why the Nobel Peace Prize is very much given to us, because that link, hunger and conflict, yeah, and how we avoid conflict by reducing hunger. But also we have worked over many years, especially in Southern Africa, you know, drought. El Nino comes almost every year now, so it doesn't rain, so drought is there. But we had like events like the freak incidents or cyclones that we had 2019 in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Comoros were heavily affected. So those cyclones left millions of people underwater, in fact. I mean, if you, I went 1 week after the cyclone to Sofala and to Manica and to the Chimanimani in Zimbabwe, and that was a disaster. I mean, like, there were no villages. They had been inundated and disappeared under the mud. The fields disappeared under the mud. The people who had been over on the trees for some days, really, it was a really climatic shock. And what does WFP do the best? I mean, we mobilize our resources. We had bought food around the region. We had food in Zambia, in Malawi, in Durban. We moved it rapidly to those locations so that people didn't spend weeks without eating. No, it was in 1 month we reached 1 million people only in Mozambique after the cyclone hit. So that shows you that what we do, we really mobilize everybody, governments, donors, to support, and we move in to reach those people in very, very critical situation. But then, as you ask, and let me try to be concise, because I'm sure Duncan can add some things here. When COVID hits and in the region, we start seeing the lockdowns around end of March, South Africa locks down 26 March, and almost the whole SADC region has locked down. And there we were, I must say, very surprised. On COVID-19, we expected mostly a health crisis. But the effects on food security, Shaka, were massive. Look, all these urban areas where people couldn't go out on a daily basis to do their job and gain their small money to go to the market and buy their tomatoes, their beans, and their maize or rice, they couldn't access any funds, so they couldn't go to the market to buy any food. So we were called by 8 governments in the region almost immediately, like 2 weeks after lockdowns, to ask WFP, what can you do for the urban people? The urban people, in fact, were heavily affected. So we came in and with the governments and other actors like UNICEF and the World Bank and others, tried to put what we call shock responsive safety net. So really increase the transfers, the cash transfers, the people who are receiving cash transfers, to all those who suddenly couldn't work and couldn't even go to the supermarket or the small shop in the corner to a spaza shop or the small market to buy the minimum diet. So that has been a big job we have done during this. So urban transfers, cash transfers has been very critical, yeah, in this COVID. And we have been extremely busy and we continue being very busy on that. And very concerning also, if I may, just to end this topic that you mentioned, is the impact of COVID not only on the urban areas, but also in the rural areas for smallholder farmers who couldn't sell their product, or if they had their small production, these women smallholder farmers, they couldn't access the market because transport was not there. So that very worrisome, because they are the source of food for this region, all these smallholder farmers across the region. So we really need to make sure that they continue producing and continue selling into the market. So we have been working on that as well, very much with SADC and with many other actors. Yeah.
Very interesting. To what extent, Duncan, would you agree with Laura that especially the crisis brought about by the coronavirus pandemic in the region, and of course the climate change, that you have suddenly seen the work of an agency such as the World Food Programme increase around wherever you move around the SADC region?
I wish to agree with everything Laura has just said. Even before the coronavirus took root in the region, we had done an assessment. We do an annual assessment of the status of vulnerability and food insecurity in the region. Mm-hmm. We had already estimated that we are 45 million people. That's about 12% of the regional population are food insecure. Now, when the virus hit and was taking root in the region, it meant that the supply chain, fortunately, it came at a time when harvesting was happening already in many countries. So the crop had matured and was ready for harvesting. But it now affected, like Roland said, because of the lockdown, the containment measures. There was that shock and break before member states and SADC decided to categorize sectors of the economy to say these ones are essential, they can continue working. But it wasn't immediate. So we experienced a lot of post-harvest losses because there was no labor movement to go and harvest. You couldn't even take some of the produce to the market. The farmers, like Laura said, they couldn't get cash because they depend on selling and then buying their provisions. Schools were closed. So we had a number of programs which were immediately affected because of that shock. And it increased the need for agencies like WFP working with the state governments to come and assist, because one of the things that happened was that governments shut schools, and we have a lot of programs, school feeding programs, where our children up to adolescents, they rely on school meals. That was suddenly curtailed. So we needed to find a way of still providing that so that we don't compound the malnutrition problems. So I would say immediately when the necessary containment measures came in, the work led by WFP and others was multiplied. Even for governments, the challenge was we needed to expand the social protection, both in terms of coverage and the length, duration, how long you're going to run, because the majority of urban population, like she said, they rely on piece works. You work for a few cents a day. As you're going home, you buy food. That was suddenly shut. How do they get food? So it had a lot of consequences, which WFP and others had to come in. Gender-based violence, for example. as people got frustrated sitting at home, they couldn't find income, also went on the increase.
Duncan, if I heard you correctly, are you referring, for example, to the report that came out sometime this year in July, where you were able to identify at least 44.8 people facing food insecurity in the region?
Correct, Shaka. That's the report I'm referring to. So this is an exercise that we do every year. And this year is, like I said, by July, we're already estimating. But when we're coming up with those numbers, we had not fully integrated the full impact of COVID. We're estimating that the numbers could go up to even 50 million as we speak because of the effects.
Really?
Yes.
How accurate, by the way, is your assessment? Because there are skeptics who are wondering, for example, about the sort of methodology that you use to arrive at such a very huge number. Could you walk us through some of the methodology that you are able to use in order to reach at that magic number of 44.8 million people?
Okay, so we have set up what we call National Vulnerability Assessment Committees. These are multi-sectoral committees with expertise from health, from agriculture, from climate change, food security experts, statisticians, and economists. So every year, they sit and refine the methodology. The key methodology that we use quantitative surveys. So these are very rigorous surveys, which we are open. We're so confident of them that we invite anyone. We'll give you data. We invite anyone to look at them. This is what we've done. Please critique. Where do you think we have gone wrong? So we do these surveys, take sample surveys statistically in many of the member states and go out and do the interviews and do the analysis. We also do ground truthing by triangulating. And then on top of that, in many member states these days, we are, after we've done the analysis, we come back and do the integrated phase classification for food security, which looks at not just our evidence, but takes the other evidence in the economy to try and prove our methodology that these figures are correct. So we've done reviews, and reviews that have been done by independent people. I'm glad to say, Shaka, that our methodologies are very, very close to what you'd get in the reality. Both the consistency and the history behind it. You can even use the statistics, the figures that we have to do projections. You are not going to come far from where we find this. Mm-hmm. And if you go on the ground, because our methodology tells you the area that has been affected, the estimated number of people, the categories of people affected, and if you are an agency that you want to test this, you can go in those areas and you find that indeed these are the people that need assistance. So we've generated so much confidence among governments and partners that they literally wait for these figures to come out and then start their humanitarian and relief programs.
Duncan, I know for sure that the World Food Program had a hand in sponsoring that research and indeed that report. Who are the other players in this?
Okay, so we must first of all acknowledge our funders who have normally funded this program, the Department for International Development of